Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 19th of December, these are our main stories. The Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, sets out the case for President Trump's impeachment. Bolivia's Attorney General issues a warrant for the arrest of the former President Evo Morales. And the mass protests in cities across Poland against a proposed bill weakening the independence of the judiciary. Also in this podcast.
This is my first child. I don't mind this for my child. I don't want my child born in tent, you know?
The vulnerable female refugees raising babies in what experts are calling emergency conditions. We begin this podcast with the big question out of Washington. Will Donald Trump be impeached? At the time of recording this, members of the US Congress were set to vote on just that. With a Democratic majority in Congress, it seems almost certain that the president will face an impeachment trial in front of the Senate. But the two sides have been locked in a debate over the course of Wednesday. Adam Schiff, the Democrat who chairs the Congressional Intelligence Committee, said the president is clearly guilty.
In America, no one is above the law. Donald J. Trump sacrificed our national security in an effort to cheat in the next election. And for that, and his continued efforts to seek foreign interference in our elections, he must be impeached.
The Republican Congressman Barry Loudermilk argued that Donald Trump was being treated unjustly.
Before you take this historic vote today, 1 week before Christmas, I want you to keep this in mind. When Jesus was falsely accused of treason, Pontius Pilate gave Jesus the opportunity to face his accusers. During that sham trial, Pontius Pilate afforded more rights to Jesus than the Democrats have afforded this president.
Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue is in Washington and gave us some insight shortly before recording this.
There's no doubt that this is a hugely historic moment. Only the third president in 230 years of United States presidents to be impeached. And we're just over halfway through, a little over halfway through the whole debate. And in a matter of a few hours, I think that's what we're going to see. What we expect is both articles to be voted through and the president to be charged.
So assuming that happens and we then go to a trial in the Senate, what's the Republican, the Trump administration strategy? Because we had Mitch McConnell saying no witnesses, and then we've had Mike Pompeo, presumably in tune with the White House, saying he's prepared to give evidence.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there's clearly a hope, I think, amongst the Senate leadership that this is a quick business, that it's over in a week or two, that there are no witnesses and that it's done and dusted and that the Republican Party can move on. The president at times has been tempted to want to insist on witnesses of his own, but maybe even going himself was even an idea floated at one stage. And then you have Mike Pompeo, as you say, suggesting he will, if he needs to or if he's required to, appearing. So there is some doubt, I think, about how the trial is going to pan out in terms of its choreography. In January. What there isn't really any doubt about, I don't think, is its outcome, because it needs 67 senators who are all jurors in this process to vote to remove the president. That would mean 20 Republicans switching sides, Alex.
Which begs the question, why are the Democrats doing this if the whole thing ultimately everyone knows is going to fail?
Well, what they say in public is that this is their constitutional duty. They are here to hold the president to account. That is their job. That is the pledge they give when they take up this office. And the Constitution provides for a process of impeachment if a president commits certain crimes. Now, those crimes are pretty ill-defined in the Constitution. High crimes and misdemeanors is effectively the umbrella term. And it's a sort of political process that decides what constitutes constitutes that? What counts as a high crime or misdemeanor? The Democrats have decided what the president did over Ukraine and what he did over not cooperating with this inquiry itself does amount to that, and that's why they're pushing this vote, these votes through. And of course, as well as all that, there are potential political advantages going into an election year for Democrats if they can say, well, you know, we did the right thing and we impeached him. Very few, three presidents in the history of the country impeached. Even, sure, the Senate didn't do the right thing, but look, this is on the president's record. Do you want to vote for this guy again?
Last question, and very quickly, Gary. President Trump has said he's not even going to watch proceedings in the House of Representatives. He surely will, won't he?
Well, it will amuse you to learn that he's probably in the air around now on his way to a rally in Michigan. And get this, and I think no coincidence, in a town called Battle Creek, Michigan, to be surrounded by his supporters when the vote happens.
Gary O'Donoghue. Evo Morales, Bolivia's former president, is currently in Argentina, but that hasn't stopped the country's attorney general from ordering his arrest. He stands accused of sedition and terrorism. Our America's editor, Candace Peart, told us more about what is going on.
Well, the ministers of the interim government that's currently in charge of Bolivia, they say that they have evidence, and it lies in some audio that they made public last month of a phone call where the voice of a man appears to be talking to a coca union leader, instructing him to organise blockades of a town to stop food supplies going in at the height of the protests during the contentious results of the election. And this audio hasn't been independently verified, but they're basically saying Evo Morales was inciting violence there.
How much support does Evo Morales have in Bolivia?
He still has a lot of support, particularly from loyalists of his party, the MAS party, which ruled Bolivia for the last 14 years. Now, Mr. Morales has said he won't be a candidate in the next elections, being organised by the interim government probably in March. But his party has designated him the campaign director for the elections. So he's going to play a key role in that. And coming up gaining support is Morales' former foreign minister, David Choquehuanca, who is likely to stand. He's gaining traction in two of the big cities in Bolivia. So with that scenario taking place, Morales is certainly going to take a very key role in these coming elections.
Briefly, though, he's in Argentina. I mean, there's no real point ordering his arrest if he's not in the country.
It's more of a political point being made there that nobody wants him back in the country.
Candace Peart. In Somalia, locusts are threatening food supplies, with experts saying the country is facing its worst invasion of the insects in 25 years. Neighbouring Ethiopia has also been badly affected. Mary Harper reports.
The Food and Agriculture Organization said the desert locusts had devoured tens of thousands of hectares of crops and grazing land. Food is now in short supply, and the livelihoods of farmers and nomads threatened. The FAO said conflict in many parts of Somalia had made it impossible to carry out what it described as the ideal control measure of spraying insecticides from planes. Locusts consume at a terrifying speed. The average swarm destroys enough crops to feed 2,500 people for a year.
Mary Harper. The medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières says a health emergency is unfolding just off mainland Greece as refugee camps on the Aegean islands see a spike in new arrivals. On Lesbos, almost 18,000 people are crammed into a camp that was originally built for just 2,000. The BBC's global health correspondent, Tulip Mazumda, has been speaking to some of the most vulnerable people in the camp, pregnant women and newborn babies.
How have you been feeling in the last while?
I feel pain in here and
your
here,
abdomen?
And my back.
Zainab is 8 months pregnant.
So you're sleeping on the floor as we speak?
I can't sleep.
She's come for a checkup at a makeshift antenatal clinic, comprising of a couple of shipping containers and tents. It's run by the medical charity MSF.
You feel a bit lightheaded, it's no wonder.
Her baby is due in just a few weeks' time, and she's worried.
This is my first child. I don't want this for my child. I don't want my child born in tent, you know?
Women living in the camp give birth at the local hospital, but most return straight back into the dirty and dangerous conditions there with their newborn babies.
Just take a number there and wait in the queue and we will see you.
Martina Kaplis is one of the few midwives on the island helping pregnant women from the camp.
The biggest challenges would be the harsh living conditions. Patients, I've got like pregnant mothers coming to me, musculoskeletal type pain disorders that are sleeping on the floor in tents with not even a mattress. Obviously, we've got this extremes in temperatures because it's the winter months. So they're coming to me with respiratory tract infections, chest infections as well. You know, one toilet for 200 humans. This is Europe. So it's pretty unbelievable.
There are around 20 or 30 pregnant women all sat on benches in this tented area. There are two midwives on today.
In my tent, in my home.
After her appointment, heavily pregnant Zainab wanted to show me where she lives. We walk up a steep, muddy hill strewn with rubbish bags and turn into an olive grove filled with thousands of flimsy tents. This is the overspill from the main government-run part of the camp, which the BBC was refused access to.
What is it like living here?
Like you live in the hill.
Zainab comes from a city that's seen months of fighting between the Taliban and Afghan forces. She's been living in the camp with her husband for 2 months now, awaiting news on their asylum claims.
Do you still think you made the right decision to come here?
I think the right decision, because if we didn't come here, I lose my family. You should choose between bad and worse, you know? Welcome to my house.
Hello. These are your neighbours.
Please come in.
This is a big tarpaulin tent,
yeah,
which is held up by these twigs, these sticks.
Yeah.
That's all that's holding this up. And then there are three smaller blue tents within this. Yeah. So these are your neighbours?
Yeah, these are my neighbour.
And this one's yours?
Yeah.
It's like a two-man, very basic, thin, yeah, flimsy tent. I see you've got a bunch of blankets here.
Yeah, really, really wet, you know? And not soft. For 8 months pregnant, it's really hard, but I wish something changed.
The Greek government recently announced plans to move 20,000 people off Lesbos and neighbouring islands into better accommodation on the mainland by early 2020. But movement on this has been slow, and thousands of people are still arriving on the Aegean islands every month.
Tulip Mazumdar, and some good news on Zainab's story. Since the BBC interviewed her in her tent, Zainab has been given more suitable accommodation on Lesbos as she awaits the imminent arrival of her baby. To China now, where Uyghur human rights activist Ilham Tohti has won this year's Sakharov Prize, awarded to those who've made outstanding contributions to the defence of human rights. Previous winners include the Pakistani girls' rights activist Malala Yousafzai and Nelson Mandela. Ilham Tohti is serving a life sentence in China on separatism-related charges. His daughter, Jua Ilham, collected the prize on his behalf. She thanked the European Parliament for awarding the prize to her father.
To be honest with you, I don't know where my father is. 2017 was the last time my family received word about him. For him, the problem was clear. Uyghurs were being denied basic rights. The right to believe what we believe, the right to worship the way we want to worship, the right to think we want what we want to think.
Our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me a little more about this year's winner.
Ilham Tohti was a very well-known academic and intellectual in China for quite a few years before he was given a life sentence in 2014. The Chinese court said he was guilty of separatism, inciting hatred in China. Ilham Tohti is a Muslim Uyghur. That's a member of the Muslim Uyghur minority in China. He grew up in Xinjiang in China's far west. He was very, very bright boy. He grew up at a very poor family and at 15 went to university. He became an economist and he started looking at these Chinese government policies that were applied to his home territory, to Xinjiang. And he said that he thought it was unfair the way they were applied. He was critical of the fact that he thought that most of the economic benefits from Xinjiang, which is really rich in resources, were really benefiting the Communist Party, the Chinese Han majority, and not benefiting Uyghurs. And so he tried to act as a moderate voice, and that's really what he became known for. He started a website that was supposed to be promoting dialogue between Uyghurs, Han Chinese, and other people in China, and he was really trying to hope that by promoting dialogue, he could really bring down some of the prejudices held against Uyghurs.
So now his daughter has accepted this human rights prize. This prize dates back to the Cold War. It has quite a history in itself. But as she accepted, she said she doesn't know if he's still alive.
Yeah, it was quite shocking when she said this, although really it's not that surprising. So Ilham Tohti was taken away in 2014, locked up for life, and she said she hasn't heard any word of him since 2017. This isn't really that unusual among high-profile prisoners in China. The Chinese prison system really doesn't do very much to try to promote any communication between prisoners and the outside world. So it's not that surprising she hasn't heard of him, but she did add that she really doesn't know if he's dead or alive. I wonder if she really made a point of saying this to try to goad the Chinese authorities and trying to prove that he's alive.
Celia Hatton. Still to come in this podcast, the show must go on. The handful of children putting on an entire nativity play in Wales. Thousands of people have protested in different cities in Poland against proposals to fine or sack judges if they question the government's sweeping programme of changes to the judicial system. The main demonstration took place outside Parliament in Warsaw. From there, Adam Easton reports.
People outside Parliament held EU flags and chanted the slogan, Free Courts. They see the proposals, which will make it easier to fine or dismiss judges who oppose the government's changes to the legal system, as a crude way to silence dissent. The European Commission says those changes have politicised Poland's judiciary and undermined its independence. Some Polish judges have begun to question the independence of newly appointed judges selected by the governing party. The government says the new disciplinary measures are needed to prevent anarchy in the legal system.
Adam Easton. Epilepsy, one of the world's most common neurological disorders, can cause sufferers to have a seizure if they see things like flickering lights. Now, the Epilepsy Foundation, a charity in the US, has said it was the victim of a cyber attack as its Twitter handle was included in scores of posts featuring videos which could trigger seizures. This is just the latest example of those with the condition being targeted by so-called internet trolls. Claire Pelham is the chief executive of the Epilepsy Society here in Britain. I asked her about these attacks.
1.5 million people in the world who have photosensitive epilepsy have seizures that are triggered by flashing lights and or fast-paced video or animation that might include coloured background images that change quickly or patterns that dance up and down or distort. It's profoundly distressing. It may mean that somebody falls over and hits their head or hurts themselves, or if they're carrying a hot drink, they might scald themselves. It's not a small thing.
So what happens? They get an email and what do they see on their screen?
So there are two sorts of causes of triggering photosensitive epilepsy. The first sort is we call the innocent sort. It's where friends might share something on Instagram or on Twitter, and it pops up in somebody's social media feed and causes a seizure. The other and much, much more unpleasant sort is, and sadly this is an increasing phenomenon, is where very, very unkind people deliberately set out to target people with epilepsy by tagging in epilepsy keywords in their social media posts and deliberately include material that they know will prompt a seizure. We at the Epilepsy Society, I'm afraid to say, hardly a week goes by without the charity receiving a posting of that kind. and it often comes with rather hate-filled messages.
Why would someone do this?
I can only imagine that they're people who are struggling with their own mental health. It's so unkind and so full of hate. We describe it as an assault. Some people call it cyberbullying, but we think it's best to call it what it is. It's a deliberate, pre-planned, premeditated assault.
And I can see why you'd say that, but in legal terms, is it an assault?
Well, I personally think that it does fall within the definition of assault in the criminal law. But one of the things that we've called upon the British government to do is to issue prosecution guidelines that clarify this. But I think the issue is not so much that there's been problems in the courts from failure to get convictions. It's rather that the social media companies are not cooperating when complaints are made to them. So many people with epilepsy have raised these issues with Facebook and Instagram, and they tend to get either no reply or, I'm afraid, rather a brush off.
Claire Pelham, the head of the Epilepsy Society. Now to a new space mission to look for planets outside of our own solar system. Yes, where there's a will, there's a Milky Way, and beyond, as the European Space Agency launches a major new satellite. Dr. Joanna Barstow is a researcher in planetary physics and told us more about the mission's objectives.
We're hoping that it can shed some light on a class of planets that we call super-Earths. They exist between Earth and Neptune in size. We don't have one of those in our solar system at all, and we'd really love to learn more about them.
Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos was watching and has more.
So it's a bit different to the telescopes that we've launched in the past to hunt down and find planets orbiting distant stars. We've got about 4,500 on the books now, and there's kind of a feeling among scientists that, okay, we've got a good number. We really need to find out some real detail about what these worlds are like. So instead of just finding planets, CHEOPS is going to study them in more detail. It's been given a list of about 400 or 500, which it's going to work through over the next 3.5 years. And it's going to watch those worlds pass in front of their stars. And when that happens, you get a very sort of a small dip in light. And from that, you can work out a very precise diameter for the world. And if you've got some independent information about how massive that world is, then you can work out its density. And from that, you can say something about what it's made of, its structure, how it might have formed, that kind of thing, even to see if it's got an atmosphere and maybe clouds, even an ocean on its surface. So it's really getting into the full study of what worlds are like around other stars.
Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos. Now, we've all heard of Hollywood, and most of us know India's Bollywood, the film industry based around what used to be called Bombay. Nigeria's Nollywood is another rising part of the film industry. But how about Kollywood, the Kenyan film industry? Well, it's not really a thing yet on the world stage, but the head of the Kenyan Film Classification Board is hoping it will be before long. He's calling on Kenyans living abroad to help finance the production of new films at home. We'll hear more from him in a moment. Mike Johnson asked the BBC's Michael Koloki in Nairobi how healthy the Kenyan film industry was at the moment.
It wasn't really well known as a filmmaking arena until perhaps about the 1960s. In 1970s, and that actually was a period where it attracted a number of Hollywood productions. In comparison to, say, what I would call film industry heavyweights on the continent like Nigeria, Kenya is still slowly becoming recognized. However, the flip side to this is that, you know, there is an opportunity for growth. The sector has attracted interest in the recent past, but, you know, there have been concerns by filmmakers here that perhaps the industry is not picking up as well as it should.
Okay, so now we have this appeal from the boss of the Kenya Film Classification Board. His name is Dr. Ezekiel Matua. I've been speaking to him. We'll pause there, Michael, just to hear what he had to say. I spoke to him on a telephone line to Nairobi, and I asked him what exactly he was asking Kenyans living abroad to do.
I want them to put their money where their mouth is. For far too long, the investments have been in real estate and other ventures. What we are telling them as government, we are asking them to use the structures created for them to be able to support the creative youth in their villages who may not be able to get jobs in Nairobi or in their cities, to nurture and develop the talent, giving them the little capital they require to make them film or to produce their music. I think this would be a great contribution to national development.
From what I can see, though, if you talk to Kenyan filmmakers, it's not necessarily lack of money, although everybody wants more money. They often talk about red tape, don't they? Stringent licensing laws, prohibitive regulations. And the truth is, there have been very few global blockbusters over the past few decades that have been filmed in Kenya. Isn't that about red tape, not necessarily funding?
Absolutely not. What we lack is the support in terms of capital for people to make films. People come to make films here. They find it easier to do business in Kenya than in any other country in Africa. What we are lacking is capital and post-production equipment to make quality films.
That's Dr. Ezekiel Mutua. He's chief executive of the Kenya Film Classification Board. Michael Koloki, also in Kenya, he says it isn't red tape, but Kenyan filmmakers do complain, don't they, that the government gets in the way sometimes.
A number of filmmakers I've spoken to have raised concern that a number of production companies that had initially wanted to film in Kenya have decided in the past to move to other countries because it was easier to get the required permissions. Now, just based on what I have seen, having just observed the sector over the past decade, I have to say there has been a bit of change. In the past, you needed a number of licenses. For example, if you wanted to film here in the capital, Nairobi, you needed the Government of Kenya film license. You as well needed a license from the city of Nairobi. And at one point, the police indicated that you needed their permission as well. And I think the filmmakers have been trying to meet with the government and discuss this issue so that the red tape is basically cleared out of the way and the film industry here is able to develop and perhaps achieve its potential.
Mike Johnson talking there to Michael Koloki in Nairobi. And speaking of acting, tis the season for nativity plays, when schools around the world burst at the seams with children dressed as wise men, angels and sheep. But on Wednesday evening, one of Britain's smallest schools was preparing to put on its Christmas play with a cast of just six. The Welsh language primary in the village of Abersoch in North Wales is under threat of closure, but its head teacher is determined that the show should go on. Our Wales correspondent, Howell Griffith, has been meeting the young stars.
Making sure every note's perfect, the children at Ysgol Abersoch Primary have spent weeks rehearsing for tonight's big moment. But this is a Christmas show on a tiny scale. Numbers at the school have halved in the last 3 years to just seven full-time pupils and two in the nursery. However, two children won't be taking part on religious grounds, and another has today pulled out due to illness. So, with just six pupils to choose from, the casting process for headteacher Linda Jones has been pretty straightforward. She says everyone gets at least two roles.
They all got to major parts, really, this year. They don't see it as a challenge, I think. They just enjoy doing it. I get so emotional with Christmas, seeing the little children do the best they can. I always end up crying anyway, and so do most of the parents.
This year's show comes with added poignancy. The local council has put the school's future under review. A decision on whether to close is expected in the new year. But they hope the village hall will be full tonight for what could be the school's final performance.
Merry Christmas!
Howell Griffith. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.